Hello and welcome to another episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and joining me, as always, my two associates, Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Well, howdy, howdy, hi.
And Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
I can't copy that. I will just say hello.
All right, excellent. Finally broke the curse. I thought that switching you up might do it. To anyone just joining us, aside from being confused about what we're talking about, you will find that the Film Stage Show is a podcast where we review a movie. This week, nothing that came to theaters this week, because everything that came to theaters was kind of unstimulating, wasn't grabbing our attention. So we'll be talking about a different release. I'm going to leave that in the dark for now, though. But first, we'll have a movie topic discussion, and then
they'll know what the film is because it'll be in the headline of the
You know what? I like to assume that people come into this fresh.
I mean, even if they listen to it on iTunes, it'll be in the title.
Every once in a while. Okay, for the podcast,
we'll be reviewing Wake and Fright, a 1971 Australian film directed by Ted Kotcheff, starring Gary Bond and Donald Pleasance.
Damn you to hell, Nick. Have you noticed, by the way, the new podcast app is awful, and every once in a while it just cuts off the title of the podcast?
Yeah, it's awful because it's part of iOS 6.
I haven't found too many problems with iOS 6. I like a lot of the changes that have been made, but the podcast app is kind of balls, like just not that great.
My biggest problem is that my iPod interface looks like a Sony device that was made in 2005.
Okay.
Like go to the music section of your iPhone and just keep that in mind.
Yeah, it's a little strange.
I'm doing it now.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. Wow, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that kind of grayscale thing, and it's anyway.
Yeah, it feels like a step back from
it does.
What I had 3 years ago.
I'm not a fan. Anyway, so yes, we'll be reviewing Wake and Fright, and after we do that, we'll be giving you our choices for what you should check out in the week ahead on DVD and new releases in theaters, as well as a random recommendation. Before we start, I'd like to thank all of our new subscribers. I know we've got a bunch of you, and it would be really super cool if you could all go and rate us on iTunes, give us a star rating, throw us a comment, and also don't forget that you can talk to us directly if you email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. That out of the way, we can get into our pre-review discussion, which will focus on Danny and Nick's time at the New York Film Festival. So, Nick, why don't you start us off, tell us what you've seen, and tell us what you thought about it.
I saw one movie, the New York Film Festival. not to sound too disingenuous, it was a very good film, and I interviewed the director of it, too, for something like 25 minutes. That'll be going online. If it's not online by the time this episode airs, it'll be probably immediately after. I saw Something in the Air, which I've talked about briefly before. It's the new film from Olivier Assayas, a French filmmaker who last created Carlos, 5.5-hour terrorism epic. This is a very different film, needless to say. It's sort of a look back at his youth growing up in France in the early 70s as a teenager who had proclivities for art and revolutionary feelings about the way the world was run. It's extremely personal, of course. I mean, I'm sure you could gather that just from having that little background, but it's entirely relatable too. And it's, I think it's probably a bit of a step down from his last two movies, but both of those are close to masterpieces, I think. So this is still very, very good. It'll be coming out from, IFC will be putting it out in the spring. So it's a little while away, about 6 months. He told me it might be coming out in May, which is kind of weird. Appropriate since the French title is After May, anyway. So yeah, it's I recommend it. It's good.
All right. And Dan,
well, I didn't see that one, unfortunately.
Well, it's kind of good that you didn't see that one, because this would be an extremely short discussion if you had.
That's true.
So what did you see that you want to give us a rundown of?
I have seen a handful of films. Most recently, I saw Not Fade Away, the debut from David Chase, who created The Sopranos. And it's kind of a mediocre debut. It it substitutes kind of name dropping or like period detail dropping rather than actually kind of embodying the era, which is the mid-1960s. And it's about a group of teenagers that form a band. The whole thing was just kind of not really specific enough of a story for me. It just kind of felt like broad strokes. The best stuff is actually between the lead actor, I don't know his name, I'll look it up really quick, and James Gandolfini, who plays his dad. And it kind of gets lost in the muck. The actor's name is John Magaro. Everything else in the movie is just not as interesting. So overall, I was not a fan of that. I actually just wrote a review that just went online. Some of the better things I've seen, there's a distributor called Adopt Films that is putting out a handful of really, really good foreign movies. One of them is Holy Motors, which played very well at Cannes. And it's just this incredible movie about an actor that kind of each segment of the film kind of plays like a short film with him in a different disguise. It's just really exhilarating. There's a movie called Taboo that is kind of split into two halves, and it almost plays like a silent movie, especially in the second half, in the sense that it's a romance and we almost never hear the two romantic leads talking.
Ooh, so it's like The Artist.
No.
I know, this will probably be good, actually.
Yeah. What's interesting is like when they're together, you hear like the sounds of like the nature and the scene, but you don't hear them talking. So it's not completely silent, but it's just a very interesting way to frame that romance. And I like the second half a lot better. The first half is kind of this weird setup that I'm not sure is justified to run for half the length of the film, but overall it's really special. The other big one was Life of Pi, Ang Lee's movie, which I liked. I didn't love. I think that the first 40 minutes are kind of like pretty slow moving exposition. The last 10 minutes is kind of like a rushed ending, but the middle hour is really good. It's about a kid who gets in a shipwreck and he winds up in the Pacific Ocean with a Bengal tiger and some other animals, and they kind of hang out. That's really good filmmaking. The 3D is spectacular, especially in the shipwreck sequence, which is probably the best 10 minutes of the movie. Let's see. The other one I'll mention is Barbara, which is Christian Petzold's new movie, and I actually interviewed him the other day. So that will be going up soon as well. And my review of Barbara is already on the site. But Nina Haas in that movie gives probably one of the best female performances of the year. She plays a woman in the 1980s German Democratic Republic who's kind of like she was caught trying to flee, and now she's put back in East Germany, and she's kind of torn between trying to forge together another escape attempt and kind of staying and trying to make a life. That's a very good movie as well.
Now, The Life of Pi.
Yeah.
I saw that trailer.
Mm-hmm. I know Nick wasn't a fan either.
I mean, it's kind of the same problem I'm having with, on a purely visual sense, with Cloud Atlas,
mm-hmm.
where it's just, like, too much. Like, just really garish. Like, is it just because you're not used to seeing that, and sooner or later you kind of get used to it? Does it suit the story well, or is it just Lisa Frank, the movie?
I mean, the thing is that the story is kind of boring. So once like the weird 3D kicks in, like it's at least different and obscure enough to kind of feel alive. In that sense, I went with it. It actually looks worse in the first 40 minutes also, because he tries to inject these like domestic scenes with like this kind of with like the same visual flourishes as he does in the rest of the movie, and it just comes off as like way too much in those scenes. But I think when they're on the ocean and the movie's just kind of all about the senses, I think the photography and everything works. And you know, I like the tiger's pretty cool to watch run around.
All right. Yeah, I don't know. I'm like vaguely looking forward to it,
mm-hmm.
just because of who's involved, and you know, I've heard the book is great, but never read it. I don't know. I like the fluorescent, sparkly whale jumping out of the water.
Yeah.
You know, that's all I've got to go on right now is that trailer. And so I'm...
This could be paradise. As plays in the trailer.
Yes. Nick Newman, frontman for Coldplay, live in the studio.
Well, I apologize.
If you... I'm absolutely serious.
I apologize for creating Coldplay.
I'm absolutely serious that if you don't, like, sing a couple songs from Les Mis for our inevitable Les Miserables podcast, I'm just going to be so upset.
Yeah, I don't know any of the music from it. We've already discussed this, but you know, I'll learn when I see the
movie. Okay, I'll send you the CD.
All right. I mean, no, I can just I'll see the film and I'll pick it up there.
Any final thoughts before we get into our review of Wake and Fright?
Holy Motors, very very excited to see that. And hint hint, the director and the star of that film will be coming up later in this episode.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Interesting. A little teaser for things to come. Yeah, I mean, we definitely want more dispatches as we see more stuff. So we're definitely going to get into that. But
yeah, I'm peeved I missed Passion.
I was about to say, but that was the one that had the issues.
The digital?
Yeah.
Issues. Yeah. That's Asayas and I talked about that, actually, if I could name drop. And
yeah, you can name drop. Name drop.
He just said it's something that really scares him, which I thought was interesting. Because I guess that happened with Carlos at a Roman film festival. Gotcha. They're supposed to show it. He flew there, and they just, you know, he kind of had to sit on his hands. Because
I mean, I heard that De Palma was not pleased.
A tweet I read said that he was sitting there with his arms crossed, shaking his head.
Yeah, I think I saw that one too. I mean, that's rough. We definitely could have talked about that again, but I feel like we've already covered that. In fact, every movie that I've had to see in IMAX 3D, I've had to bring that up because they're constantly failing. What is happening to our world? Anyway, now that I've had my vague existential crisis for the day, let's move on into our feature review, which again is of Wake in Fright, a 1971 Australian film directed by Ted Kochiff, starring Donald Pleasance and Gary Bond.
Perfectibility. Progress. A vanity spawned by fear. A vanity spawned by fear.
Okay, so that was the a snippet from the trailer for Wake and Fright, which is an interesting film. It's about John Grant, who is a school teacher who's been bonded to teach in the Outback, which is, I don't know. I've never seen the Outback depicted as anything but like a barren hellscape. Everyone should be pretty well acquainted with it. And he's supposed to take a Christmas holiday, but he ends up kind of getting stranded in a town called Bundanyaba, which everyone colloquially refers to as the Yaba. And it's all about the kind of mental and moral degradation that he undergoes while he's there. I don't want to say too much because that would be getting into spoilers, but we can explore our outlying feelings about this before we dive into the plot. So, gentlemen, let us begin with our spoiler-free discussion of our feelings on this movie. And let's start with Danny.
I thought Wake and Fright was really creepy and really good. It just kind of got caught up in the atmosphere of it from the very beginning, which is this like 360 panorama shot of just this vast open desert. Soon after that, like you said, this teacher kind of falls into this town called the Yaba, and he goes into this bar, and it seems like it's kind of a normal thing. Like guys are buying him beers, and he has some guy buys him a steak, and you know, normally that'd be a pretty good night. But there's something really creepy about it from the very beginning, because there are these moments where they like drink their beers in one sip and it's so weird, and then they just get another one and they keep going. And the way the sheriff kind of behaves is very weird. And it keeps getting darker and darker from there. and I was really going with it. I thought that, you know, there are maybe some scenes. One of the reasons that it was so little seen on its initial release was this very violent scene of kind of animal brutality late in the film. And you can maybe make the argument that it goes too far there, but I kind of like the idea that it had this goal of just showing this character break down, and it followed it through very strongly. So I was a big fan.
And Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think I like this movie very much. And I watched it a week ago, and I've been sitting on it trying to figure out what exactly didn't work. Because after it ended, I don't know, I kind of rolled my eyes a bit because it felt simplistic and there wasn't that gut punch effect that I felt Kotcheff was aiming for. And yet, in the time since, I've realized that's not exactly the problem. I think maybe the root of my issue with Wake and Fright is that there's a certain aesthetic repulsion I have to the film. It's a very ugly movie. And I'm not necessarily saying that as a total criticism, but I think it's supposed to look quite unpleasant. There's all the dirt and the sweat and the stains of the outback. And yet, just watching the film, I didn't enjoy myself in any way because I just wanted it to end. It felt as though I was sort of being suffocated by it. And maybe that's part of the idea, but that doesn't mean I like it or that I enjoyed the experience of watching it. And yet, at the same time, I still do think it was a bit too easy. You know, guy goes to this place of low moral fiber. He loses whatever moral fiber he himself has, and then he goes home. And that kind of, when the film ended, I kind of asked myself, was that it? Was that really, this is what left Martin Scorsese speechless, as the quote on the poster says? Yeah, so I'm quite conflicted about it, I have to say.
I think I fall somewhere in the middle of you two. I had no idea what this movie was going in. I mean, I know 1970s, it's a movie called Wake and Fright. I was expecting some kind of exploitation thing, you know, some dark, dank, gross freak out, especially when you hear that it's like a lost film. Because it wasn't available on VHS or DVD for the longest time, and I knew there was a controversy, but I had no idea what it was about. And I was probably about an hour and 20 minutes into it when a friend texted me and said, you know, what's up? And I said, I'm watching this film. And they asked how it was. And I said, it's really good, but I'm like an hour and 20 minutes in and I'm not entirely sure what the plot is. Because I had no idea where it was going. And I wasn't sure if it was building to something. I was getting a lot of different vibes from it. And horror was one of them, but also just that kind of bleak existential slice of life, like slow degradation thing. And I was expecting something towards the end, like Straw Dogs, because that was the film I kept feeling the most kind of, and I'm not entirely sure why.
It's very Sam Peckinpah-ish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just that, you know, you got this school teacher who's out in the middle of nowhere and everything's kind of grating on him and he's losing his sensibilities. But I also had the feeling like, you know, in a lot of horror movies, there's just that upper class dude who goes to the lower class area and doesn't try to not piss anyone off. Like, he just goes out of his way to like make people dislike him. And John in this movie doesn't have so much that problem. He's a little short with some people, but these people are so freaking nice in their own way. Like, Danny was talking about them drinking. Holy God. Like, that's all they do.
It's so funny at times.
Yeah, like, oh.
It's a little, it kind of made me feel sick as I was watching it, because I was thinking to myself, at what point do you have to stop?
Yeah,
because this, I mean, they drink so much beer.
It's so much beer, and then they wake up and drink more. There's a point in the movie where not only do you see the crushed cans, but you see this guy making a necklace of the pull tabs, because this was before the pop-top cans. So you'd have those little, like, razor-sharp pull tabs with the finger circle in it. Then you pull it off, and he's making a necklace of it. And the thing is, like, 20 feet long at some point. And I'm just like, how the hell did they drink that much? But it's things like that that kept me invested. Because, I told my friend, I liked the film. I was on board, and I was invested, but I didn't know where it was going. And having seen it get there, I'm not entirely sure that it earned what it was going for. And I'm not even still entirely sure what it was trying to say. Like, I don't get a sense of where this character is going to go after this movie is done, if that makes sense. Like, his continuation in the world is a mystery to me. But, yeah, I don't know. I liked it, but I'm not sure that it's as successful as I would have liked it to be. I think it's beautiful. I loved the soundtrack. It's one of those really creepy, yet slightly jovial soundtracks that you don't hear much nowadays, but were really big back in the day. The soundtrack vaguely reminded me of The Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man. And I don't know. Like, this movie, I unfortunately couldn't watch it until just a few hours ago, and I kind of wish that I'd had a chance to watch it earlier in the week, and then I could watch it again. I feel like I need another viewing to really sink into it.
Yeah.
On the whole, I mean, I would definitely say that anyone who's interested in it should check it out. And I'm surprised by the amount of accolades that it got. Like you said, Martin Scorsese, I mean, it left him speechless, and he selected it as, what was it, a Cannes classic?
Yeah, he saw it at Cannes in 1971, believe it or not, and then it came back in 2009 for this.
Yeah, and it was nominated for the gold, the Palme d'Or, wasn't it?
The Golden Globe.
The Golden Globe. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like it. I don't know that I get behind it that much, and it may just be one of those films that maybe it was a product of its time, and we're not going to be able to see it the way that they did then.
Yeah, even though I didn't like the film that much, I do want to see it again, and I'd be willing to look at the Blu-ray of it because I've heard that looks quite good. It's struck from a 35mm print, which of course Drafthouse Films are releasing, and it's thanks to them we were able to see it. But part of the reason I mentioned the Blu-ray is because the screener that I watched, you know, I put it into full screen on my computer, and it kind of looked washed out, sort of. And I feel like even though there is a lot of ugliness in the specific physical design of the film, I feel like there could be a sort of a beauty akin to, I don't know, Once Upon a Time in the West or something. But I couldn't really get that here, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was wondering that because at some point as the sun was coming through the clouds, the light changed in my room and I had to adjust the brightness on my monitor, and suddenly I went through this massive crisis of, have I been watching this wrong? Did I have it too dim? Was it too bright? And, you know, I think that's one of the things that's going to hold home viewing back for me. Because now, having liked the film and having appreciated the aesthetics of it so much, I would like to see this in a theater, like, projected correctly, or on Blu-ray, you know, just in a dark room on a good TV. Yeah, I don't know. Good film, but slightly wonky in execution of its theme, I think. Does anyone have anything else they'd like to say about this before that is non-spoilery?
The kangaroo scene was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was... I wasn't sure if that was a spoiler or not.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so yeah, that kangaroo scene freaked me out for a second, because I was like, man, this is pretty brutal. I wonder how they made it look so real. And then at some point, it started dawning on me that could be the nebulous controversy I'd heard about. And
yeah, that was part of it from what I've read.
Yeah, I mean, there's a producer's note at the end that said, what was it? It's like it was an actual kangaroo hunt that was done by like licensed professionals, and the kangaroo is apparently a threatened species. I had no idea. Maybe they're not anymore. But
yeah, the producer's note made like no sense to me.
Yeah, they were like what? Because the kangaroo's threatened, we decided to keep it uncut. After talking with a bunch of advocacy groups.
We know it's bad, but fuck it.
Yeah. They're like, well, we already killed them. We don't want it to go to waste. It didn't make a lot of sense to me either. But I was like, well, he must know what he's talking about.
You know what's maybe funny is that you know, you see a few kangaroos earlier in the movie, I think, and it's not often I see kangaroos anywhere, so I started asking myself in my head, you know, could you really box a kangaroo? And what would that be like? And in the movie, a guy kind of boxes a kangaroo.
Yeah.
And it looks like it wouldn't really be fun, no, like in a cartoon.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it just, like, nobody really wins that.
They have those fight. Claws, man. That's pretty...
Yeah, that was a creepy shot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That whole thing was nuts.
I was thinking that their drinking kind of, like, led them to make poor decisions, maybe.
Yeah, I feel like that might be one of the themes of the film. Maybe. So, yeah, let's get into spoilers, I think. We can talk about some of the scenes that maybe did or didn't work for us. And some of the strange things that happened towards the end. This film, basically... Let's stick with the kangaroo scene for a bit. Like, I think one of the things that I'm having trouble with on this film is, until the kangaroo scene, I didn't get that much of a sense of this guy kind of breaking down. And I feel like it really hit the gas quite strongly in that scene, and that it hadn't really earned the intense amount of brutality that it had built to. I mean, yeah.
That's my biggest problem with the movie, is that he kind of seems like... I feel like there's a lot of suggested complexity in the character, and it almost gets there. It gets about halfway to three-quarters of the way there, but then it kind of slips off. And so when you have this sudden transformation, I thought, really? Is he that weak-willed? He just got drunk, and now he's at rock bottom? It felt so quick. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the scene that worked a little bit for me came before that. Because, first of all, he loses all of his money, and that scene actually... it worked for me. Like, he plays this ridiculous game where you bet on the outcome, not of a coin flip, but like a coin throw. Like, they put two coins on a plank of wood and then just toss them in the air. So he gets a lot of money. He gets, I think, like, what, like $490 or something like that. And then he's like, you know, okay, I'm bonded, but if I have $1,000, I can pay off my bond and get the hell out of this hellhole. And so he goes back and loses everything. And then he cashes his check. And then he loses all of it. Like, he has no money. He has a dollar, which is a reoccurring theme throughout the film. That worked for me, because there was desperation there. And I think they wanted to use him losing all of his money as kind of, like, cutting his safety line and, like, just making him unwind. And then again, there's so much weird hospitality in this town. People just keep buying him drinks. And they seem to be on a constant mission to make him drink. And this leads him to go home with an Outback rancher guy. I'm absolutely uncertain as to what anyone's profession in this town is, aside from the people who own bars, because that seems to be the only thing that makes any money. And then he goes and he takes a walk with this guy's daughter, and they are about to engage in some sexual intercourse. That's a really awkwardly constructed sentence. I apologize.
It was an awkward encounter.
Yeah.
It's appropriate.
Yeah, and then he, like, throws up. And I don't know. I feel like that actually robs that scene of whatever impact it might have later on in the film.
It's very relatable.
All right, Nick. I mean, I don't know. Like, for me at least, if he had actually consummated that relationship, that, like, 14-minute long relationship, and then had found out some of the stuff that he found out later, that would actually help me out with understanding why this character goes the direction he does. But as it stands, like, he's knocking at the door and then throws up and then it's over. And then he finds out that, like, apparently this girl screws everyone in town. And the crazy drunken doctor and her have some sort of weird sadomasochistic relationship. And apparently the woman is a rapist.
Wow.
What was that, Danny?
That's just a lot of gruesome detail, Jesus.
Well, we're talking about the movie, right? But I mean, like, yeah. He finds out all of this, and he came close to engaging in it, but was rescued by his low tolerance for alcohol. And I feel like that remove should keep him from really plummeting to the extent that he does. Like, am I alone in that, or do you feel like that was enough? Nick, I'm assuming, since you said that you had the same issues with I did, that you might have other ideas and instances of the similar kind of reticence.
Sure. Well, one thing that I talked about, how we almost get a complex main character, and one of the things that kind of threw me off was that about 30 minutes into the movie, he encounters the Donald Pleasance fellow, and he sort of has a dialogue with him that suggests he's actually, because he's acting nice and he seems amiable and et cetera, et cetera. But then he has this dialogue where it sort of suggests that he's actually a prick. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wasn't expecting that reversal. And then the movie kind of doesn't, I don't know, it felt like it didn't really continue with that. It just sort of had him be a jerk for one scene where he talks about the sheriff while he's gone,
yeah,
who he was getting along with. And then it sort of resets. It felt as though it reset. And that really kind of bothered me because I liked what angle they appeared to be aiming for there. Yeah, where it went from there, I wasn't too keen on. Yeah. Or I shouldn't say that. I should say that what was happening with the character I didn't really care for.
Yeah, he was very hot and cold on this town. Like you said, yeah, he was hanging out with the sheriff and seemed really nice. And then the second the sheriff is gone, he starts really denigrating the guy and the town as a whole.
Yeah, and I was thinking to myself, like, he was pretty nice to you. He, you know, he showed you how to get food and he bought you beer and...
Yeah, he gave you a great steak. I mean, I don't know. I was kind of able to get over that because I thought, okay, this is who he really is. Like, this is... He does hate this place. Like, mm-hmm. And he's just trying to be nice. And I thought that him losing the ability to be nice around other people would play into it. But it didn't really.
No. It kind of washed off.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about my frustration with this film. Like, there's certain aspects. Like, that character beat, then the actual action beat of him learning about this kind of sordid culture that they have, and then just kind of diving headlong into murdering kangaroos with a knife. Yeah, I don't know. There's a part of me that wonders, because I know that they shot kangaroos for this film, obviously, and now I'm wondering if they actually stabbed one to death. Because never having... I'm like you, Nick. I don't see a lot of kangaroos, and I don't know what they look like close up. So there were times when I was like, well, that looks a little fake. And I was like, well, how the hell am I supposed to know? It's a kangaroo. Danny, did you have a defense for any of these things that we're talking about? Because I think you're a little more positive.
I was actually going to... I'm glad that you guys brought up that moment where he kind of bad-talks the sheriff, because his kind of prick aspect to his character, if we want to just call it that for shorthand, I, like, really felt that throughout the movie. And so I think that that's kind of the difference between us. And I think... a lot of it comes through the performance, which I think is great, because to me there are all these moments in his interactions where you can tell from his facial expression that in his head he completely, like, hates and disrespects these people that he's talking to. And what I like about the movie is that the environment it puts him in allows him to discover that about himself. So, like, you know, obviously, like, I don't think the movie would have worked if he felt like a normal, nice guy to me. But I like the idea that he was deep down kind of this sadistic guy, and the situations he was thrown into allowed him to come to that realization that he probably maybe never would have had otherwise. Because to him, when he's kind of bad-talking these people, he obviously thinks he's above them. And then he ends up being as sick as them, maybe even more sick. I don't know, because he's doing these things and he's not content with them, but he keeps doing them. He keeps taking their beer. So that actually, that worked for me, as opposed to you guys who kind of just felt it for that one moment, maybe.
I mean, I agree with you insofar as what they were doing and why it was better than it could have been. It's just, I wish his discovery had been modulated better. Because I do agree that, like, this guy comes to the realization that he is just as bad, if not worse, than these people who seemed, like, there's this weird sense that, like, the Outback doesn't so much corrupt people as it does just, like, bring out aspects of their personality that might otherwise be tamped down by, like, civilization. I mean, that's definitely reflected in the end where he decides to try to take his own life, which is something that is seeded earlier in the movie by the sheriff saying that there's not a lot of crime and not a lot of issues of any kind, except for the fact that every once in a while someone kills themselves. And I think it's, you know, that point where, you know, you've seen the beast inside of you and you can either handle it and embrace it like a lot of these people do, or you're just like, well, this isn't for me. And then you put a 22 caliber rifle to your head. 22 calibers, by the way, not the best choice of a suicide weapon. Those are not powerful guns. But that's completely unrelated. Danny, you were about to say something?
Well, I was just going to agree with that like thematic analysis. I really like that idea of the movie. But one other aspect that I could kind of maybe concede that was like maybe poorly handled was kind of his relationship from his past with this like girl he has in his wallet.
Oh yeah, Robin, his Sydney-based girlfriend.
And that's just kind of a really strange subplot, because there's kind of a moment early where he's on the train and he's falling asleep and we see him like dreaming about this girl. And then later he tells one of the townspeople's daughters about her, and then she just kind of never comes back. And it was strange to me, that part of the film.
Yeah, that's another one of those things where I kind of know what they're doing, but didn't think that they executed as well as they could have. Because, I mean, you know, it's a good way to kind of anchor the concept of, like, he's got something in civilization, and he's slowly losing sense of it or shape of it. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I appreciated what they were doing with it at first, but after a while, it did kind of lose itself. There's a hallucinogenic scene towards the end where he's kind of having all these flashbacks to things that are happening on top of visions of what he assumes is happening. And she comes up in that, that weird sequence of ideas. Now, to anyone who hasn't seen the movie, this question might not make a lot of sense, but I'm hoping that someone, one of you perhaps can tease it out for me. When he's having a vision of Doc having sex with, Janet, I think it's his name is Tim's daughter, the guy who picks him up at the bar. At some point, he also envisions Doc having sex with a blonde-haired woman. Do we know who that is? Is that just like a random person they threw in there? Or is that supposed to be like a surrogate for his own self?
I don't even know if I remember that.
I don't remember that specific image of like the blonde-haired woman.
Okay. All right, so no one can answer my question.
Was it then like you couldn't see her face? Or?
I think so, yeah. Like I'd have to go back and look for sure, but I'm pretty sure that it's pretty clear who she is. And part of me was wondering if that was like his repressed means of remembering his own drunken night with Doc, because John is a blonde man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because there's definitely an inference that something happened between him and Doc.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty disturbing stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like what sets him off. Like, that's the lowest that he goes. And I don't want to get into like a big philosophical, moral, human sexuality discussion right now. Is that really like the lowest he could sink, is having sex with a man?
I don't think it's about sinking to, I mean, well, perhaps in Australia in 1971, the social politics were a little less PC than they are today. So perhaps, I mean, to the people who made this film, I don't want to make suppositions, but I maybe they were, you know, maybe, but I would say it's more about him sort of just kind of going all out, you know. I it took me a long time to say that because I feel like there are a lot of improper answers I could give, but
well,
maybe that's not improper, but
you know. No, I mean, I know what it could mean, because you have to look at things either from like a social level or a character level. And I mean, from a character level, I guess it kind of makes sense that would be his hang up and like the final straw, because he couldn't have sex with Janet. And he's constantly thinking about the girl back home. Well, not really even back home, back in Sydney. And so it would be a little bit unnerving for him to have not only had a drunken night of passion with a stranger, but have it be a male, something that he's so clearly never thought of. And so maybe
it's also a guy who's kind of like a rapist.
Yeah, I was going to say, also not like not a good guy.
Not the nicest guy. I mean, like, he'll buy you some beers, but...
But then again, in this town, who won't?
Yeah.
there's a great scene where he's actually yelling at someone as he's trying to hitchhike the hell out of here. And the guy's like, here, let me buy you a beer. And he's like, no, I'm cool. And the guy starts to get really angry. And he says, like, you know, burn down your house, rape your children, that's fine. But, like, heaven forbid I should turn down a beer.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Yeah. And it does kind of give you a good insight into what these people, like, if they're not feeling the camaraderie, like, you can do all kinds of things. But the second you turn down kindness from them, That's you've just brought the hammer down on yourself. Yeah, I don't know. Like, the again, these are things that I'm glad the movie makes me think about these things, because that does let me know that it is a successful film in some respects. Though, again, that wishing that it had done something a little bit more kind of holds back my enthusiasm on it. I'd still recommend that anyone go see it, because it is, you know, a pretty good example of making a beautiful and vaguely challenging film. What do you think, though, about the final scene where he goes back to, what was the name of the town he was in? The teaching town.
It was like Tabuki or something.
Tabuni or something like that. So he goes back to this town, to the hotel slash motel he's staying at, and the guy who he'd talk, it's Tabunda, in case anyone cared. He goes back to the hotel he'd been staying at, and earlier on he'd had a conversation with the proprietor, and the proprietor was like, you know, are you coming back? And he says, you know, of course, where else am I going to stay? And he leaves, and then he comes back, and the proprietor is, of course, on the porch drinking a beer, and sort of, like, laughs to himself when he asks the guy, John, if he had a good holiday. And he's just kind of, like, staring off into the distance and, like, laughing knowingly to himself. Like, what do we think that that's saying? Any and all opinions are welcome.
I think he just kind of knows about the Outback, basically. And I think the physical stature of himself said enough. Does that make any sense?
I think
his appearance kind of said it all.
Yeah, like the guy knows that he didn't make it back to Sydney. Like, he knows that something happened.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering what he... I guess it's the same question that I have regarding the character. Like, this is a man who hates this place with a passion, goes on this kind of moral odyssey, discovers some unsettling things about himself, does some unsettling things, tries to kill himself, fails, and then they go back to the teaching town, and he seems altered. He goes on the train, he gladly accepts a beer from someone after just having railed against drinking so much, and then he wanders back into his abode, and the guy's kind of like laughing, and he's like, oh, I know what happened to you, but where does he go from there? Like, is he now gone native, so to speak, or...
I don't know. The ending of this movie felt very... I feel uncomfortable saying it felt familiar because it's an older movie, so in some ways it probably precedes a lot of films that have endings of this sort.
Correct.
But it definitely felt, I can't so much put into words, but it definitely felt like an ending I've seen before, where it's the character has lost his moral compass and then the film ends ambiguously on a morose shot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes... I don't know if that example was... clear enough, but it just kind of felt a little I kind of shrugged it off, honestly.
You kind of shrugged it off?
The ending, yeah.
Okay.
Just because I thought, I've seen that before.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked the kind of synchronicity between the opening shot and the closing shot, where it's the sort of high angle,
sure.
You know, looking around. And there's this implied question of where the fuck are you going to go?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so bleak, like...
But that's what I mean, though. Like, I've seen it before, so it didn't have quite the... Again, it's what I said before. It didn't have that gut punch aspect it was so clearly striving to deliver.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I understood it on an academic level, and I feel like if they had tweaked a little of the character stuff that we talked about earlier, it would have been more effective. This is a movie that academically I can appreciate, but that lacked some of the emotional punch. But yeah, like I said, still all in all very good. I'm considering buying it because I don't know. I don't know about the title, though. And that's a stupid quibble to have with a movie. But I feel like it's a little too exploitation-y. I don't know. I don't expect anyone to actually comment on that.
I think it's a cool title.
I like the original festival title was Outback.
Yeah. Wake and Fright, though, it sounds really good.
It's a great phrase, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, it sets up this idea. The movie's much more nuanced than that, I feel. And so I guess it kind of gave me this, like I said, I was expecting, you know, the Wicker Man slash, you know, Straw Dogs. And this is a little, this is much more subtle than both of those films. But yeah, that's I think that's all I have to say, unless anyone else would like to bring up a final topic before we move on.
Rex Reed called it the greatest Australian film ever made.
Rex Reed is dumb.
Just wanted to see Nick's reaction to that.
What would you say the greatest Australian film ever made is?
Warrior? What's that movie? Babe 2.
Oh, Jesus. Pig in the City.
Agree.
Yeah.
I was going to go...
It's another George Miller film, just like The Road Warrior.
I was going to go Picnic at Hanging Rock, but...
Ooh, I actually just got my hands on that, so I will be watching that soon.
You know, I don't like that movie that much.
Really?
Picnic at Hanging Rock. Yeah, I watched it, and it was sort of like Wicked Fright, actually. Maybe Australian cinema is not my thing.
Maybe, I was about to say. They are pretty hung up on this... And you know, it's a unique continent in that way, like this interplay between the civilized areas and then the outback is just such a forbidding place.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of lingering on that and how we like don't belong there.
Yes, but what is civilized and what is uncivilized there?
Exactly. This is a question that the proposition brought up very well.
See, that's a good Australian film.
That is a great Australian film.
Have you guys heard of Last Ride at all?
I have heard of it, but I have never seen it, nor do I know what it's about.
Yeah, it got a really limited release this year, but that's another Australian film with Hugo Weaving and his kid. He's kind of a fugitive, and they just kind of travel to the outback, and it's another kind of striking example of that kind of setup.
What else is there? There's Rabbit Proof Fence. There's Walkabout.
Yeah, I mean, Walkabout.
This is a constant struggle, apparently, for the people of Australia. This pull towards something dark out there. And I mean, that's part of what I like about it. Cause you know, there's not many places that have that theme that they can plunge into. Like what would America's analog for that be?
Cloud Atlas.
The Old West.
I was about to say the Old West kind of works, but we kind of romanticized that. Like I don't think I've seen Las Vegas. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Some guys just can't handle Vegas.
I guess I don't know. Africa and Russia have places that probably would go with that, you know. But I feel like America, we just don't have any place that we can look at it and say that place would bring out the demon in you.
The South.
The South is okay. I'm going to stand up for the South. The South is kind of awesome.
I'm not going to say anything.
Have you been to the South?
I've been to the South.
Every place that I've been to in the South is like the friendliest damn area.
I'm gonna bite my tongue.
Okay, we're gonna wait for a movie. You know, it's too bad we didn't do this when the original, or not the original, the remake of Straw Dogs came out, because then we could have had some discussions.
The Paperboy.
Oh fuck that. Let's not. Let's just kill this right now. can we all agree that you should check out Wake and Fright?
Maybe.
You had said that you wanted to see it on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
is that more just to see what it's like?
No, I want to see it again now that I have a better idea of what to expect. I'm just not sure who I'm going to recommend this to. I don't know if they would bite.
The original poster for this is actually pretty excellent, and it has a great summation of the film's theme. Let's see. This is the U.S. theatrical poster, according to Wikipedia. And, I mean, the artwork is a little bit, I don't want to say grotesque, but again, plunging that exploitation idea, but it says Outback, which was again the original title, and it says have a drink mate, have a fight mate, have a taste of the dust and sweat mate, there's nothing else out here.
It looks like the cover of a 70s sci-fi novel about the nuclear holocaust.
It totally does. A man with more suitcase and his gun. Yeah, I would say that I'm not going to say who directly I would say to see this, but it is a very good film. If you're interested in it, you should definitely check it out. I mean, we've had a pretty great discussion about it, so I feel like if you're the type of person who likes to see a film and talk about it afterwards, you could do a lot worse than Wake and Fright. Danny?
Yeah, I feel like I probably liked it the most, so All right. Check it out.
Groovy. That brings us to the latter part of our podcast, where we'll look forward to what's coming out and let you know what we think your best bet for having a worthwhile cinematic experience is. So coming out on October the 9th to DVD and Blu-ray, we have Prometheus, Rock of Ages, The Raven, Crazy Eyes, A Cat in Paris.
There's more coming out than that. E.T. is coming out on Blu-ray.
Oh, see, mine are all just new releases. I don't know where you go to see all these other crazy
things. I usually go to Blu-ray.com or Blu-ray.HiDefDigest.com.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll rewatch E.T. I haven't seen that in quite some time, so, you know. Yeah. That's actually a much better sci-fi alien movie option than Prometheus.
I was about to say, like, sticking with the... Because I feel like... You know, everyone's seen or knows E.T. I mean, Prometheus, it's new, and that would be the thing that people might buy just because they didn't check it out in theaters, in which case I'd say don't.
I would recommend it because I like that movie, but, you have a better option.
Is this the extended cut? Because I know they said they were putting out an extended cut.
There is no extended cut. It's just deleted extras. Scenes. From what I've heard, though... And this will really piss you off. From what I understand, the deleted scenes actually answer a lot of the questions.
Yeah, there was the one scene that they talked about where it's like they find a fossilized one of the vagina cobras, right? And they talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of clear now that they cut those scenes to make it mysterious.
I guess.
And what a good job they did.
Yeah, so mysterious and impenetrable that it makes no sense.
Looks good.
Look good.
I like that movie. It's more like it's sort of dumb fun, which is a problem when it's clearly trying to be more than that.
You're right. It is pretty dumb.
Yeah. There's a few other things I want to mention. Strangers on a Train,
which
is coming out on Blu-ray, as is Dial In for Murder 3D, which I've never seen that in 3D. I know Film Forum in New York was showing that for a while. I wanted to go. Shut Up and Play the Hits, the LCD sound system, final concert, last waltz-ish thing. Wanted to see that. I will see that. I'm definitely going to rent it. Also, music-related, Magical Mystery Tour. Has anybody seen this?
I have not.
No.
Do you know what it is?
No.
It's a one-hour TV movie that was written and directed by the Beatles. And it stars them, and it's sort of a companion piece to their EP/album, depending on what country you're in, also called Magical Mystery Tour. This film is unbearable. It is so bad. From what I understand, they actually publicly apologized for it in the newspapers of England days after it aired, because it is...
The cover is horrendous.
It's so... Oh, it is really terrible. It's almost
that is a fuck awful cover. Like, I skipped by it. I didn't even realize that was it. That is ridiculous.
It's the cover of the album too.
Oh my god.
It's a great, great album. That much can be said. The film, oy.
Yeah. I'm gonna say I'm looking at Blu-ray.com, so they have a lot of the re-releases that are coming out. Because everything new, like The Raven, Prometheus, Rock of Ages, I would not recommend. So I'll offhandedly recommend the Blu-ray release of The Great Mouse Detective and the Blu-ray release of Red Dawn.
Ooh.
Which, spoiler alert, I'm going to be talking about later.
Ooh. All
right, Danny, what about you? What are you going to say we should check out?
I got to go with the Hitchcocks. You kidding me? There's no question.
All right. Excellent. I mean, I would also recommend those, but I wanted to get something else out there since they'd already been taken.
I've never seen Strangers on the Train, actually.
Oh, I probably like that more than Dial In for Murder.
Strangers on the Train really is a great film.
Yeah.
It's funny, we were talking about this before we recorded. I just finished rewatching Vertigo, so good to know.
I've seen, this is kind of on topic, but one of my professors wrote a book on Hitchcock, and he's like a Hitchcock freak. So I've probably seen Vertigo 4 or 5 times in a classroom setting just at my first year at NYU.
Jesus.
Wow.
Yeah, so I need about a year off from that movie, even though I think it's amazing.
Going to take a step back.
Yeah.
All right, then that means we can move on to what's coming out into theaters the 12th. We have Argo, the newest film by Ben Affleck, starring Ben Affleck, Bryan Cranston, John Goodman, Alan Arkin. It's about the fake movie that they used to try to get some hostages. What would you call these people? Refugees?
Hostages?
They're not hostages. They're not being held hostage. But
they were the Iran hostage crisis.
Yeah, but these weren't the hostages that were part of that. These were people who were trying to... They had escaped to the Canadian embassy. They were like living with the Canadian ambassador, and they were worried about becoming hostages.
Give me one second. Do I know what this film is about?
Argo with Ben Affleck?
It's
basically the same thing. The Iranian Revolution, like they...
Yeah, okay. I didn't really know that, but they're in Iran and they're sort of hostages.
And there's a movie script involved.
I would say they're potential hostages. They're people that we don't want to get captured. They're not refugees. They're just people who don't want to die.
We can fret, once you're a hostage, are you ever not a hostage?
I guess. Anyway, Argo, which is I've heard it's pretty damn great. Yeah. Sinister, which I've also heard is pretty damn great. Ethan Hawke plays a writer who moves into the house of the family he's writing about, who was murdered. Finds some Super 8 films and some supernatural shit happens. That was really selling that short. It's supposed to be really good. Here Comes the Boom, Kevin James, whatever. Seven Psychopaths, which is the new film by Martin McDonagh, who did In Bruges. Stars everybody. Colin Farrell, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Christopher Walken. Oh, man, I can't remember.
Abby Cornish.
I was going to say Abby Cornish, and then there's...
Tom Waits.
Olga Kurylenko.
Kurylenko, yeah.
And then there's that character actor who I really like, whose name I can never remember. I think it's like Ivan Zeljnik.
Oh, Zeljko Ivanek.
There we go. Yeah. See, I am so sorry, sir. I love your work. but your name is a nightmare. Then we have War of the Buttons. No clue. And then Middle of Nowhere. Also, no clue. Anyone have any... best bets on this crop? Surprisingly strong, actually, given the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I saw Seven Psychopaths actually like over 2 months ago. I guess I can admit that now. That sort of that admission can be made. Very good, very funny. I'm still thinking back on certain scenes, particularly Christopher Walken's line about the cops. it's in the Red Band trailer, so you can look it up. But sometimes I'll just sit around, obviously when there's no one else around, and I'll just say that out loud, and I start laughing to myself.
This is a dark insight into your mind and life.
Yeah.
I sit around making a Christopher Walken voice. No, I saw Seven Psychopaths. No, this is great. This is like the one time that I've actually seen a movie before it came out and could have this kind of insider vibe. I saw it Wednesday, and it was pretty fantastic. So I definitely think you all should go out and see that. That being said, I mean, I wouldn't discount Argo or Sinister.
No, I want to see Argo.
Yeah, I want to see Argo as well, and I want to see Sinister as well. And that's rare that I want to see a horror film.
Mm.
So I feel like if Ethan Hawke is in a horror film, like it might be something decent.
Because he's not one to usually go for shit just because he needs a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Which
are we doing Argo or Seven Psychopaths? Do we know? Next week? We could do a combo.
Well, everything coming out the week after next kind of sucks. So whatever we don't get to next week, we can talk about. I won't say what's coming out next week, but spoiler alert, none of it looks that great. So we will probably do Argo and Seven Psychopaths. Just going to be a toss-up as to which one comes first. Possibly Argo, since it's going wider, I think. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But yeah. Danny, did you give us your...
Argo.
Argo? Okay. So Argo and Seven Psychopaths, and then Sinister if you're looking to get scared. And now it's time for our random recommendations. Nick, let's start off with you.
Okay, so I mentioned, I hinted at this earlier, but my recommendation for the week will be The Lovers on the Bridge, a 1991 film directed by Leo Carax. Is that how you pronounce it? Or is it Carra?
I've heard Carax.
Okay, Leo Carax, starring Denis Levant and Julia Binoche. Watch this movie, obviously, but go into it not really knowing anything. Just know that it's about two people who find love on the bridge. In a way, they find love in a hopeless place, you could say. I was expecting some laughs, but okay. So it's one of those movies that after it ended, I just kind of almost had nothing to say because it was I felt as though words would just kind of be useless in that instance. It's so beautiful and so assured. It's great. I couldn't be happier that I watched it.
All right. That's a pretty strong recommendation.
Yeah.
All right. So get out and see that, people. Danny, what about yourself?
I was just going to say, it's on Netflix Watch Instantly, but from what I understand, it's a 4x3 version. I watched this on a DVD, so just get the disc.
It's a good note. Danny, what about yourself?
I watched Pasolini's adaptation of Oedipus Rex this week because I was reading that for school. It was an interesting movie. It kind of, at the beginning and the end, he kind of sets it in Italy during the early 1900s, and then the middle, probably 90% of the movie, goes back to ancient times and just tells the story that pretty much everyone knows. And I almost wanted more of the stuff in the present day. I thought that was like the most interesting part of the movie. But overall, I'd still recommend it. It's kind of a signature Pasolini film. It's very static and slow moving, but also very evocative. And obviously it's a great story that has been around for a while.
Okay. Me personally, as I said earlier, I watched Red Dawn, the classic 80s film, the first PG-13 film ever. Would not get a PG-13 today. Way too much.
Because of the scene where the guy pees in the truck.
Yes, exactly. Nothing to do with the immense amounts of blood. Because you're really not allowed to show blood in PG-13 movies anymore. Because everyone knows that violence has no real consequence. It's a discussion for another day. Red Dawn, really very much a product of its time. It was the last time that America could even pretend to be something of an underdog on the world stage. And it involves a Soviet invasion of the country, which is just as absurd as it sounds. It opens with just a massacre of some high school students, and then just keeps going crazy from there. And follows Patrick Swayze, Leah Thompson, Charlie Sheen, bunch of other kids, and then Powers Booth is in there too at some point, and they are fighting back against the Reds as the Wolverines, which is their school mascot, which they appropriate as their gorilla outfit's name. Yeah, it's cheesy. It's a little bit, you know, drenched in the red, white, and blue, but it's a damn good film. I enjoy it. I'm assuming both of you have seen it.
Oh yeah. I've seen this movie many times.
It's great.
Solid.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No interest in the remake though.
No, the remake looks terrible.
It's supposed to be.
I don't doubt it. I mean, like when it was China, it kind of made sense. Like, okay, I guess if we're going to choose someone, it can be that. And I mean, the original film sets up the world in which this could happen with such, I don't even want to call it economy, because like that makes it sound like. It's just like four flashcards that have like facts on them that are just setting up why suddenly America is alone fighting a communist invasion.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if they make sense, like contextually. Like some of them just seem random and out of order. Like it talks about the Soviet Union invading Poland. Like what does that have to do with anything? Doesn't matter. It's really good. But I feel like the remake is going to make absolutely no goddamn sense whatsoever. This film is a great one, and I was watching it with my 3-month-old niece, and I'm going to make her first word Wolverines. I'm going to do it, and my sister's going to kill me, but it's totally going to be worth it. So that's my random recommendation, and hey, it's on Blu-ray now, so if you're one of those people who doesn't deign to watch DVDs anymore, you now have no excuse. So that brings us to the end, and a sad moment for all of us, I'm sure. Again, check us out on iTunes. Give us a comment. Give us a rating. Tell us your opinions about anything we've spoken about at podcast@thefilmstage.com. We'll see you next week when we'll talk about something, either Seven Psychopaths or Argo. I would say it's going to be a surprise, but as Nick helpfully pointed out earlier, you'll probably see the title when you either go to the website or download this. So it's only a surprise up until the point where we actually tell you. Before we go, gentlemen, why don't you tell us where you can be found on the internet, Nick?
Thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And Danny?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
You can find me at thefilmstage.com as well as my personal blog, dearfilm.net. And you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rome. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, once again for joining us, and we look forward to speaking with you next week.